Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
And welcome back to another episode of the Storybox Podcast. My name is Jay Phantom, and this week we're talking about lots and lots and lots of food. That's right, you heard me correctly, because we got Sir Isaac Eats a Lot on the show, and his wife Sammy Eats a Lot. They talk about competitive eating. Well, Isaac talks about competitive eating, eating a lot of burgers, what it takes to eat a lot of burgers, his life in eating a lot of burgers. It's a lot of fun, that aspect of it. But then we get into the more serious side of things with talking to Sammy and what she's had to go through, what they've all had to go through really as a family. It is quite a inspiring, challenging and moving story. So this week on the show, I'm delighted to have them both on. They've actually become quite good friends of mine now, so really appreciate Isaac actually, you know, coming on the Story Box, and, you know, we've actually been able to form a friendship from this. So he's been really supportive of the Story Box, so thank you so much for doing that, Isaac. Shout out to you once again. But he's got quite a big following on Instagram for what he does, and he's very, very good at what he does as well. And Sammy, at the same time, she has her own journey, so I encourage you guys to really listen in to this week's episode of the Story Box. So let's dive in to the Story Box and hear Isaac and Sammy talk about their story. So Isaac eats a lot and Sammy eats a lot as well. Thank you so much for coming on the Story Box podcast. Have you been knighted yet? Because the amount of food you eat, I'm curious.
I've been on my knees a few times, but usually it's doubled over with stomach pain, not getting a sword on the shoulder, but I'm waiting for the letter in the mail. So.
I'm sure if the Queen saw your Instagram page, she'll be definitely like...
She's looking for a new prince spot, right? It's vacant.
Yeah. who left? Prince
Harry.
Prince Harry, yeah.
One redhead for another redhead. I'll just slide right in there. It's all good.
That's good. So if you could please introduce yourself a little bit more, so what you do for a living, why you do it, how it all got started, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was a trained pastry chef, and I was working in pastry just posting sort of pictures of chocolates and cakes and stuff. Instagram at the time was very fresh, so it was really just sharing anything and everything. And then my hobby was competitive eating. So... Oh. I would post these cute little very precise chocolates 3 or 4 days a week, and then on a weekend I'd post a big stupid like 15 patty cheeseburger.
And you ate the whole thing?
Yeah, yeah. So at the time, like, it was literally like all I did was work and do the competitive eating stuff, so I was decent at it. And that's obviously where the name Sir Eats a Lot came from. Like, as competitive eaters, it's a bit like wrestling. We all had like Monica type character roles. And I always ate quite... when you see some other competitive eaters, it's quite a monstrous, vicious thing. I always ate quite reserved, and so I kind of got like the gentleman's tag, which is where Sir Eats a Lot comes from. So once it was really like, as Instagram really blew up, like it kind of went a bit like TikTok is now, 5 years ago, I was posting these pictures, and I was just fortunate enough that it kind of took off. It got traction. I was one of the few people doing competitive eating and using social media. Like, they've always been competitive eaters, but just the nous to capitalize on an app as it launches. And so a few friends and I were all in the same boat. Instagram really kind of like hit us. We got swooped up in the euphoria of getting likes and whatever, clickbait. So obviously then we ate more, posted more. Following just grew and it grew quite exponentially, like for the first couple of months, and it shocked us and whatever. But from there, it was easier to build a reputation, and from a reputation, monetize it, and from monetizing it, start a business. So wow. That's kind of the Cliff Notes version of how I got from pastry chef to
So what made you want to be an actual pastry chef?
Always loved food. Always loved eating it. I guess I kind of liked making it, but eating it's better as I know now that I've moved away from cooking. But it was just a love of baking. I took 6 months off from – I started at university, took 6 months off for a gap year and just started baking cheesecakes and a few other sweet things, and then went on a family holiday to Europe and kind of really just fell in love with the culture of it and the – I guess the – not the love of it, but just the appreciation. In Europe, there's a lot more appreciation for the art of pastry making.
Yeah.
Australia, we just see it as sustenance and a means to eat.
Yep.
But that's certainly like why I got into pastry.
Well, nowadays it's picking up because of social media has been a huge help. Like I've found like cafes and restaurants and all that sort of stuff in terms of with pastry as well. They post a photo. It looks insane.
Oh, yeah.
Like I want to actually eat it. And some of the photos that you post as well, I cannot believe that you eat all that. How do you do it? Like what's the secret?
Like I look like I eat a lot of food and I do in a small period of time, but in reality, and Sam can like attest to this, I will go through periods where I might not eat any food for 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
So it's I always look at, instead of like a daily breakdown of calorie intake or how much I've eaten, 3 square meals, I always look at it as sort of over a week, and I probably consume the same amount of food as an average person. It's just I eat all my food between 9 and 3, 5 days a week. So I might go out and eat 4 lunches on a Monday, but I haven't eaten anything.
So it's Saturday, spaced Sunday. Out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's just, it's to be honest, it's not that I deliberately do it that way. Living in Campbelltown and Sydney's traffic the way it is, it's just to suit my job and my lifestyle. It's better off clustering things. So I will, if I'm going to eat, it's a big day, but then 2 days a week and deliberately 2 days a week, 48 hours, I just detox and eat nothing.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know that part. So I was always curious to know how people actually did it, like competitive eaters.
Balance, yeah.
Yeah. The balance, just trying to find it, like the calorie intake and that sort of thing. Because if I was to do it, like I know my metabolism is quite slow. So like I wouldn't be able to eat that much food in one sitting because it'd like literally give me a heart attack or my kidneys or my entire bowel would literally rupture. So when you first started, was the demand quite big? Like was there a lot of people actually doing competitive eating?
Or? Nah, look, when I first started, like obviously Man Versus Food, Adam Richman had made it hugely popular in the States.
Yep.
And I reckon going back almost 10 years now, like 2010 was when that American culture really started trending in Australia. We started getting more cable TV, more access to streaming online and this sort of thing. And so there was always a gimmick element to it where a pub in the outback would do a big burger or an American-style diner would have a hot dog challenge. But I think the bulk of the public, and even to today, like 10 years fast-forwarded with social media and stuff, the bulk of the public still kind of find it squeamish.
Mm.
They love it and they hate it, and it's polarizing. I know it's confronting. I'm water off a duck's back to me. So if I'm eating something stupid and 25 people stop and stare, I really don't care. But for a lot of people, that makes them uncomfortable and stuff like that. So when I started, it was quite difficult to find challenges and venues that would be willing to do it because they were worried about the effect it would have with their regular customers and sales and stuff. Now I think you could go to almost any venue. And particularly if you went to them with like a good pitch, a solid background of why you think it would work, most places would implement a food challenge. And you can look around Sydney. Some of them aren't as well known as others, but certainly like I could rattle off 10 or 15 right now that the average Joe could go and have a crack at.
So where do you find these places? Like you just look through Instagram, you just drive around. Like cause I know in the early days, like there weren't many cafes or restaurants actually putting themselves on social media. So how did you actually go about finding those places?
I was really fortunate, like because I had the persona of being a competitive eater. Like I got a lot of stuff secondhand. People would find out about it because it was their local, but they weren't competitive eaters or would never do it, but they would send it to me or share it to me or my friends that would then pass it on to me. In this modern day, it's so much easier. Like whether you're looking at hashtags or other competitive eaters, because there are a lot more on social media now. There's an Australian sort of body that regulates and helps coordinate with websites and stuff, dates and where you can find these sorts of challenges. But it's also just, I think, having the I've always been like a scheduling Nazi. Like, we're about to go on a holiday to Melbourne and I've already got 3 days lined up with five venues each day and logistics and transport. So I've always had an acute awareness on sort of how to look for things and where to find them. Wow. And it's just searching certain key terms, or you know that a certain style of place is more likely. Pizza, pasta is easy to do comp eating.
Yep.
Ice cream places, it's easy to do comp eating because food costs are relatively low and you can bulk it out.
Yep.
You're never going to find a food challenge really at like a high-end steak place or
I wonder why.
Yeah, just cost of goods. Barbecue places won't do it because the labor it takes to produce the food, they won't get ROI on doing it. But for someone to like, it's no harder to cook 3 kilos of pasta than it really is to cook a regular serve. It's the same pot, the same water.
Yeah. So have you found that with the meat side of things, what do you prefer the most with in terms of challenges? Do you like doing the pizza pasta ones or because I know you got a lot of burgers.
Yeah, yeah.
Which look, is pretty insane.
The reason I love burgers are like a nutritional pyramid in your hand. Like, there's carbs, meat, fats and dairy, fruit and veg, grains.
If you decide to put the fruit and veg on there.
Nah, yeah. Pickles. Yeah. That's a vegetable. But it's funny. Like, I think none of them are easy. None of them are harder. It's just learning the strategy to attack them. Meat will probably fill you up faster because it's a protein thing and your metabolism processes it slower. Carbs, and particularly like refined carbs, white breads and stuff, process really quick.
Yep.
And so, but then you get like blood sugar spikes and insulin levels and stuff. And also the issue being eating the food's not always the biggest challenge. Sometimes it's, if you've consumed 3 kilos of food, say it's meat, very high in sodium. Once you're finished, you are thirsty. And so the first thing you want to do is drink water or drink fluids. Now, yeah, keeping the 3 kilos of food down is fine. You add a liter of water on top of that and it's struggle street. Or carbs absorb water. So you eat 3 kilos of pasta or pizza with heavy crust and you're there. Those ones are harder to swallow because obviously like the carbohydrates also dry your mouth. So then you're consuming liquids at the same time to help you eat it. And it's just what you picture versus what would be actually in your stomach are two different things because it just gets heavier and bigger.
So how do you get past that mental barrier of actually continuing to eat this food? Because I know it's going to be very, very hard. Like once you reach a certain point,
yeah,
you're sort of getting fatigued, the food's starting to hit you. So what's going through your mind as the food's hitting you?
Usually it's like probably 50-50 fear of failure. Certainly when I first got into competitive eating, like I didn't have heaps. I was living away from family, away from friends, didn't have a heap going for me. And so the sense of accomplishment, the sense of pride in winning something when it was an individual effort was really satisfying. And I think it doesn't matter where you are, whether you're starting out first ever challenge or there's some guys in Australia that are doing 300-400 in their career now, it's still a fear of failure and a sense of accomplishment that really drives you. I always, when I'm referring to competing, it's kind of like marathon running. I'm sure marathon runners haven't run 25, 30K and go, I feel great. Like it's a walk in the park. There's a pain barrier and it's just about mentally thinking about what's in front of you and sort of like not what's behind you.
Mm. So has it been, what's the most challenging thing you've ever had to face with competitive eating?
In terms of sort of like what was the hardest thing to get through or what have been the biggest challenges in just dealing with competitive eating?
Dealing with competitive eating, like the aftermath as well, because I know you got the tough part in between and then you got the aftermath. So how do you heal yourself? And then you want to do it again because
No, there have been plenty of times where 6 hours after a challenge, I haven't wanted to do them ever again. And to be honest, like, I think the worst thing is I learned early on, like, to try and do daytime challenges. If you do a 6-7 o'clock at night challenge and then try and lay down to sleep in 3 or 4 hours, forget about it.
Yeah.
Just because horizontally you're not digesting as quickly, things settle, your digestive system slows down during sleep patterns. And so on more than one occasion, I've kind of done a night challenge, got until 11 or 12, going, man, I have to go to sleep. I have work the next day or something. Go to sleep. 2 hours time, you wake up, you're sick. Because your body's just like, whoa, you weren't ready to sleep. But mentally you're tired because all of your blood is going to your digestive system to try and do things. So you feel drowsy, but you can't physically lay down and sleep without creating issues.
So what are some of the issues that your body faces?
Oh, look, I'm not going to say like delirium or anything, but certainly sweats, like your core body temperature raises ridiculously. I think bloat is a huge thing. Like I've had rib pain because sort of just your diaphragm can't expand as much as your stomach wants it to.
Yeah.
And then the issue is if you want to be true to it, like there are some people that will voluntarily evacuate to ease pain. If you're trying to see it through, then it's just nothing happens quickly. So you're looking at 12 to 24 hours of bloat, gas, potentially diarrhea or vomiting, sweats. I know, like, I've done a couple of chili challenges before.
Where the sweat,
like, even your perspiration stings. So the backs of your knees, in your elbow, like in the inside of your elbows, is stinging for 12 hours. You can get like sort of rashes from the sting because it's technically like a burn, and that's not even including like touching your eyes, going to the bathroom.
Jeez.
Yeah. So it is like no one, I mean, there was a female just recently on Australia Day passed away from competitive eating.
Really?
She choked during a Lamington eating competition, blocked her airway. So I never tell everyone to like do it willy-nilly. Don't do it if you're not serious about it. Whenever we did it, like we went in, we prepped for it. We prepared with the outcome. We had a strategy. And so touch wood, fortunately, none of my friends or I ever really got seriously injured.
So do you know how many competitive eaters there are now?
I couldn't tell you like an exact number. I'd say there's easily like 30 in Australia that identify as competitive eaters and do it regularly.
Wow.
There's always like your dark and stormies. Is that the word where like they've never done it before, they come out, they win something or do really well at something and then they'll never do it again. They're just like, oh, right time, right place, or a mate dared me to do it. And you're like, part of you would like them to sort of persist because whatever grows the sport or grows the industry is good for it. But at the same time, everyone's competition. Mm. And if there's a chance that they'll get better than you or sort of take a share of prize money or competition wins, you're also like, good, all right, just go back to your hole now. Yeah. Stay away, yeah.
How do you get better? Like, is it something, because it's not like a marathon where you got to, is it like a marathon? Like you got to keep
certainly
like training for it?
It's, and it depends on what your strengths and weaknesses are. Like there are some guys that can eat food really quickly. They just, that mouth to stomach, like gullet area is ridiculous, but then they might not be able to eat as much. There are some guys that can't eat quickly, but could just eat nonstop for 45 minutes and rack up a ridiculous bill at Sushi Train. So I think it depends on whether you want to be like all around. And so you do a little bit of everything or you focus, like you find what you're good at and you just hone it and hone it and hone it. Certainly with capacity stuff, like a lot of people just do water training, which is just the practice of consuming like more and more water on a regular basis, overloading the stomach, stretching it. But with it being water, like obviously it's there's no calories. So your body will just pass it through.
Yep.
If you tried capacity training with food, then you'd forever be in a world of pain because your body just takes so much longer to
100%
to pass food.
So what's the best thing in your experience? What's the best food that you've ever had?
Oh, to do a food challenge.
To do a food challenge.
Nah, surprisingly, like as nice as ice cream is, I did one in San Francisco and the sugar spike and the drop in body temperature because it was already a cooler day And it was a half hour challenge. And I reckon 20 minutes in, my friend and I had physical shakes. Oh. My teeth were chattering. And you're trying to eat, and we were recording it, and you're trying to like save face, and people are watching. And then the after effect of like just the sugar drop after it, like because it spikes so much and then comes down. Yeah, it's ridiculous. I think anything where there's like variety, it's why burgers are good, because burgers have a good ratio usually of different elements that you can break up flavors. The things that are a struggle are things that deteriorate quickly. So pizza's great while it's hot, but if you're eating pizza for half an hour and the crust cools, the toppings cool, it goes from really enjoyable to like really chewy and difficult quite quickly. And also just if you've got sort of like a meter of pizza and it's all one topping and it's maybe a topping you don't like imagine eating a 1 meter anchovy olive pizza with artichokes and you're like, I don't like any of that, but that's the challenge. Certainly. I mean, there's a couple of great German beer hall challenges going around where you might have to eat half a kilo of sauerkraut.
I could do that.
I'm not a beer drinker. So they all come with like a liter stein of beer. Some of the hardest challenges I've ever had to get through were drinking a liter of German beer when you're not a beer drinker. After eating food. So you're already squeamish.
No.
And the last thing, because you've left it till last because you don't want to eat it or drink it.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
I think I could do the sauerkraut because I love my sauerkraut.
Yeah.
But beer, I can't do. Like
the bathrooms weren't nice after that challenge, trust me. Oh.
So how long have you been doing it for now?
I'm slowly sort of like easing out of it just because of my age and family and work priorities. But I probably started 10 years ago when I'm 28 now. I probably started when I was 18, 19.
So you're still very young.
Yeah, so, fortunately. I don't think it's a sport that sort of seniors or they're not going to have like a master's games for competitive eating anytime soon.
Mm. So Sammy, as well for you, your Instagram is Sammy Eats A Lot too. Are you into the competitive eating challenge things or you just like eating a lot of food?
No, I'm in this purely by peer pressure.
Yeah. How did you feel when we first met and you sort of were public and present for a few of my first eating challenges?
Yeah, look, I was pretty horrified because I think the very first one we did was Miss America's.
Mm.
Yeah. And they brought out this huge, huge burger for him. It looked like it was a cob loaf sized burger. And people stare, and I'm a fire sign, so I get fired up when people stare, and I'm like, what are you looking at? What are you staring at?
Yeah.
But he's just like, that's just the spectacle of what he does. And I think now I've just eased up and I'm used to it, but every now and then I still give the stink eye. I'm like, what are you looking at?
So what's going through your brain when Isaac's eating all that food? Like,
well, I'm glad that we have a second toilet so he can't use our bathroom. But look, at the start I was a bit mortified because we just started dating and I'd never seen that before apart from Man versus Food. So it is a bit confronting, especially the first time my kids saw it because the first time they saw it, they did it at Bar Luca and his burger was so huge that all these other people were taking photos of it. And, like, they're just these quiet little kids from, like, Western Sydney. They're like, what the hell is going on? But I think now they just take it in their stride and they're like, oh, yeah, my stepdad's on Instagram.
Yeah. That's good. Now I want to talk about this media company for a moment. So how did that all get started?
So obviously, like, I had the personal Instagram and it was doing well by the time I started the media company. And it really came to fruition out of necessity. So there was a period of time where I was still working casual kitchen work here in Sydney and our son, Teddy, was born premature. So he was born 27 weeks or 27 and a half weeks.
26.
Yeah. And like I was blessed in the sense that I was working in Liverpool and he was in Liverpool Hospital. So that was great. But then the reason for his premature birth was my wife had a cancer scare. She was diagnosed with
stage 3 cervical.
Do you mind
talking
a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's fine.
So I was in a position where, like, in a kitchen job, it's not sort of an office job where you can do it from home. It's not something that I could just walk out on if the hospital called. And I was looking at my options and I already had obviously the knowledge of how to use social media through my own personal accounts. Mm. And I had friends that owned venues that I was eating at regularly to help promote anyway, that I kind of just had the idea that, and social media is not for everyone. You could be a great restaurateur. You can be an amazing chef, have zero tech skills, zero ability of taking a good photo. So I just kind of pitched to a couple of them, look, you don't look like you're enjoying it, or you don't look like you've got the time to commit to it. Would you pay me X amount to sort of handle your social media and manage it? And in a way, it made me realize like that I could work mobile, flexible hours, spend more time with my son at the hospital or when he came out of hospital. It freed up my wife to sort of get the treatment she needed or not have the responsibility of a child with her. So it was really born out of necessity in the early days. And then I think just through results, success and persistence, it kind of grew and grew and grew over the years.
So what's the secret of a good social media presence or getting a lot of following, and for you, like?
Well, I think from day one on any social media, like, content's king. You can be persistent. You can have a great personality. If you're posting photos or videos that people don't engage with or it isn't eye-catching, then just give up. Mm. Like, I think you're wasting your time. And that's where my skill set probably has benefited venues the most, like the ability to capture photos and videos of food in its most gluttonous or its most sensual, satisfying nature. And then obviously, like, you can't just be a facade. So you've got to have a good restaurant that backs up whatever you're putting out there. And just consistency, like posting one amazing picture a month isn't good enough.
Yep.
Because the cafe that's posting average quality content every day in your face is going to be at the front of your brain when you go, I need a coffee, or let's go get a burger. So it's just the marriage of like really good quality content and then consistently sharing it and engaging with people.
So we'll come back to that in a moment, but I want to sort of touch on the cancer scare. So what can you talk to me about what happened with that? Like,
Okay, so on Christmas Eve, I started having contractions and I was like, no, this can't be. But, yeah, by the next morning I was like, okay, kids, you have to go to your dad's because I need to go to the hospital. And then when I got there I was in labour. They slowed it down, but then my water broke on Christmas night and I had Teddy the next morning. And because he was so premature, like he was 3 months early, I was due to have him in March and wow. I had him in December. And he was no bigger than a bag of sugar when he came out, like wow. He was 1 kilo. And then when they tested like my bloods, my placenta and everything, they realized that like I had cancer. Like when I was in labor, the obstetrician had said, look, there's a lump, I want you to go get checked. But no one picked that up prior. Like I had plenty of scans, my pap smears were up to date, but no one picked up the fact that I had cancer. And then when they decided, like when they found out that I had, I went through all the staging and it was pretty advanced. I was at stage 3B.
So what was going through your mind when you initially found out that, oh, it's cancer?
First and foremost, I still had a baby in hospital. Mm. The baby was going to be in hospital for at least close to 3 months. So we had him as our priority, and the second priority was I'll start treatment straight after. Because he's in NICU, I couldn't have radiation on chemo or still go to see him. Mm. So I made him my first priority to worry about, and then I started second. So as soon as he came home, I started chemotherapy and radiation.
Was there always a fear with Teddy being premature? Was there always a fear that you might lose him early? Or
yeah. There was like, I remember it still in the NICU ward, there's a big wall that has little sort of badges on it of all the premature babies and the weeks that they were born. Wow. And I think probably out of 100 badges, Teddy would have been fourth or fifth for like most premature born the day and still sort of survive. I don't think they listed the babies that didn't survive, unfortunately. But it was confronting. And it being my first child, like any childbirth I think would have been confronting. But for it to have been under the circumstances, it was like I was shitting myself, honestly. And then not being able to connect with your baby when it's your first straight away and seeing it struggle and things like this.
It's connected up to tubes.
Yeah, it just wrenches at your heartstrings. But it was just the double whammy. Like,
yeah,
we had him at the foremost of our thoughts, but in the back of your head, then we know, like, it's not the end of it. Like, even if he makes it through.
Yeah.
My goodness. That's an incredible story right there. Like, how did you guys get over all that? Like, was there a support system in place?
I ate food. The day that she gave birth and transferred from Campbelltown to Liverpool, I came home for the night, and I think it was Boxing Day.
Yeah.
So everywhere was shut. I stopped in Woodbine, where there's a KFC, a Macca's, a Red Rooster, and a Pizza Hut, and I think I just went to every corner.
Yeah.
And ate burgers on all of them. Came home, had a shower, got a bag, went back to the hospital.
Yeah, that's 100%
it. Goodness me.
Yeah. He just eats his feelings. That's how he.
Like, seriously. My. So ice cream is not your comfort food. It's burgers.
But, well, burgers, now I'm at a point where I really eat for content. And so ice cream's never going to be of value to me secondhand as Instagram content. I think comfort food wise, like, because of my work in pastry and chocolate, like, I'm always going to be a fat kid. Yeah. When we go to a cafe for brunch, we'll always get an order, and it's like big breakfast with bacon and the petite French toast with dolce de leche. And they bring it out and they try giving Sam like the sweet and me the big brekkie. And we're like, oh yeah, no, it's the other way around. Can I get the one with the edible flowers things? And then like the one with the extra bacon's for my wife. Yeah.
Wow. So that's so good. So with that, I guess the journey of getting over Teddy, did he start to like rapidly improve, or how long did it take for him to actually improve?
He was a fighter. So he was meeting the milestones as they required. Like, he came off his oxygen, he was feeding. It was more so size, because he was born so early. He was so small.
It's because he's half Asian.
Yeah. You can't say that.
don't blame the prematureness for your undersized genes.
But yeah, like he hit his milestones within their parameters, and then he got to come home. And even when he still came home, he was tiny.
There was always the fear, though, like, of underdeveloped organs still.
Yeah.
Like, even when he was in hospital, they thought they found, was it his brain or his lung?
Yeah, he had a little brain bleed. Wow. And then he had to keep getting injections to grow his lungs. And when you're in the NICU, you've got corridors from, like, okay to worst case scenario. We were in the last. So it was hard coming in, and then you'd see other little babies around him, and then the next day they weren't there anymore. Mm. So, like, we were blessed in the sense that he never had a, like, he never went backwards. He always went forwards in progressing. But still, it was really stressful. Like, I used to just come home and just bawl my eyes out, because, like, people I'd see that I hadn't seen them for a little while, they're like, oh, where's your baby? And it's like, oh, my baby's in hospital, but he should come home soon. But it was a really long wait to come home with him. And then even when he did come home, like, you'd shit yourself and think, like, what if something wrong happens during the night? Because you were so reliant on doctors and nurses to be around. Mm. But now he's perfectly fine.
It's about putting your trust and your faith in the doctors to help your baby, and you're trying to get some rest at the same time, and you've also got the knowledge that you've got cancer and you got to deal with that hurdle.
Yeah.
So after you got through everything with Teddy, what happened with the cancer?
So when he got home, I started all the tests for staging. So I had a couple of like day surgeries going in. So on our very first day surgery, they do all sorts of tests, and they actually gave me a pregnancy test. And at that point, I was pregnant again.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm like fertile. It's ridiculous. Yes. I'm ridiculously fertile. So in the first staging procedure, they realized I was pregnant again, and the doctor said, look, you really need to do this. We need to see how far you are. The baby probably won't survive. And at that point, I had to put myself first, because I had four other children at home, and I said, yeah, that's fine. And then 2 weeks later, they do another scan to see whether or not everything, like, there's no longer a baby, and there was a heartbeat. So, like, even though, like, my cervix was Chernobyl at that point, there was still a viable heartbeat. And then that's when the doctors had to have the discussion with us that I had to have a medical termination in order to finish my staging and then start treatment, because irregardless of whether I kept it or not, they said that if I was to see the pregnancy out, I may not survive.
Well, they were giving you, when they first diagnosed you, like 6 to 18 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it was advanced stage 3. And the joke of it, not the joke of it, because I shouldn't laugh, but like talking about how fertile she is, she, when we decided we were going to try for a child, she came off a contraceptive method that she said in the past took 6 to 12 months for her hormones to kind of kick back in, and we conceived like the next week. But in a hindsight, like if we hadn't conceived so damn quickly and Teddy hadn't been born prematurely at 27 weeks, knowing that at that stage it was advanced stage 3 cancer, like if all of the cards hadn't kind of lined up, then she may have just kind of never known about the tumor until it was too late, or just never known about it. And one day we come home, she's sort of passed out on the tiles, and we're like, oh, well, Sam's not had too much to drink.
Yeah.
But so it's funny, like all of the trauma and all of the hurdles we've gone through, kind of if it wasn't for all of them,
yeah,
things would have been completely different.
Mm. Yeah. So what was going through your mind when you had to make the decision to put yourself first and this time terminate the baby inside?
Look, it was hard, but like I thought to myself, I've got 4 kids at home. So it's like, do I have one more that potentially grow up without a mother, or do I terminate and then still like put up a good fight to be here for my 4 other children? Mm. And it, like, there'll be people that are like pro-choice and that sort of thing or anti-abortion, but at the end of the day, like I had to make a decision for my kids, and that's what the decision was. Like I needed to be here for them and really try to survive, because I was at the point where I was like, do I even want to do this to my body? Because chemo and radiation, like even though it's there to like kill your cancer, it leaves like such like damage afterwards, so much damage. So there are things where I was like, I wish I didn't have to go through that. But if I didn't go through that, I wouldn't be here today.
Mm. So what was it like having to go through the chemo?
Look, it was really tiring. Like you've got a newborn baby and 3 other kids at home. So I'd have chemo and radiation on a Monday and then radiation every other day except for the weekends. And then for the last 3 weeks I had to have brachytherapy, which is internal radiation, where I went and had surgery. Like I'd go in, Isaac would drop me at Liverpool Hospital at 5:45. I was 6:45 in the morning, and I'd be like self-medicating, and they'd just put they put rods up in your cervix to implant radiation pods. And then you just come home and you just feel dreadful.
But how much did you try working through all of that? Like you were still working.
Oh, no, I went back to work 2 weeks after.
So what were you doing for work?
Yeah.
What were you doing for work?
I worked at the university. So I was working as village manager for Campbelltown, Bankstown, with the residential students that still lived up there. So I went back to work 2 weeks after I finished treatment. I did ask for a little bit longer, but unfortunately due to business needs they did.
And it was just difficult too. Like we'd had sort of time off because of his birth and paternity leave and stuff to be at the hospital. So I think we'd kind of it's not that we'd exhausted the sympathy card, but because the two incidences were so close together, like you had exhausted sick leave.
Yeah.
And because we were providing for 4 kids in a rental, we couldn't afford to take too much of a hit income-wise. Because whether I was chefing or doing the media business, like neither are exactly rolling in the pineapples. So it was, again, like kind of a necessity that you needed to go back to work.
But
it just wasn't great, I think, in your recovery, because then it was another stress, another physical exertion.
Yeah, because I was just so tired and sick. But, like, you don't show that when you go there, because I think a lot of people's misconception of having cancer is you being bald and frail. And I was, like, I had hair and I was still fat because I was pumped full of steroids every day. Like even though like I had a PICC line in my arm for where they would connect up, like when people would see me, they'd go, oh, yeah, she's fine. She just looks tired, and she's probably tired because of a young baby. But no, I was tired because I was just full of toxins and cancer at that point. So
and even now, but I think there's a perception like, oh, you have cancer or you don't have cancer. Mm. Like you're sick or you're cured. And it's not the cancer, it's the 18 months to 2 years afterward where your body has gone through so much and you've altered it in ways that sometimes are sort of irreversible or unrepairable that people still go to me like, oh, and you know, Sam's good now, like after the cancer. And I'm like, yeah, like the cancer's touch wood in remission, but it's the ulcerations or the this or the that from that are all after effects of chemo and radiation that are probably more harm or more like have impacted her life more now than the 2 or 3 months of the harsh treatment did then.
Because like it does, like doing all that, it does send you into early menopause. So I went into menopause at like at the age of like 32, 33. And then like because of the radiation and it being where it is, like I had like third degree burns on my colon. So even just to go to the bathroom, I'd have to take painkillers and bite down on like on my shirt. And it was just people don't realize that that's like what you have to go through. They just think, oh, you go and like you get your chemo and then you're done. But like it's just it's so much pain. But like you just get through it because you've got kids and you've got to just you try not to see like let them see you suffer as much as like you're suffering behind closed doors.
Incredible power behind that sort of determination and mentality. I've got a couple of friends of mine that did have to go through cancer themselves, and I had a friend of mine that had a very, very premature little baby. It was so tiny. And just seeing, like, you see it in their eyes. You see it,
like the resilience. Yeah.
It's like we've got to. It's determination for them. Like it's the human intuition, human resilience is absolutely incredible. Like, so what year was this? When did that happen?
2017.
Was
when we went because Teddy was born Boxing Day 2016.
Yeah, so all the treatment and stuff happened 2017. And my Chukru Media, like the media business, started January 1st, 2017. So literally 5 or 6 days after Teddy was born, we made the decision like, all right, we need to change things to make it work. Yeah.
And are you still doing the university stuff now? Or?
No, I'm actually working in real estate.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Now you're speaking my language. Yeah. I used to do real estate. Yeah. I used to work for McGrath for about 7 months. Yeah. So in the Castle Hill District.
In leasing or?
No, in sales, actual sales.
Or? Yeah, in sales.
Yeah, nice. So I did quite well in that and, you know, things didn't really work out too well with the boss I had. So decided to move on and I'm sort of doing like a consultancy thing. So I got my full license. I've just got to
find a realtor,
find a place to use it. You know, I still got that sort of skill set and the drive. You know, I just one of those hidden talents you don't know about until you actually do it.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the process of sitting down with people, talking to them and hearing their story as
Would you ever, do you think that it's the same skill set for real estate as like say car sales or do you think they're similar but different?
Similar but different. And I'm saying that because for real, it depends on the person.
Yeah.
Like for me, I always put my integrity above everything. So I made sure that before I told someone this, I knew that if I wasn't going to buy it myself, I'm not going to sell it. You know, there's no point in me telling you a lie just for the sake of this because then I'd ruin my reputation. I'd ruin my integrity. I'd be known. I wouldn't be able to live with myself.
Yeah.
I'm not that sort of person, you know, like I never have been. Always been brought up with that mentality or that good character, you know, like you've got to treat people the way you want to be treated at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think the reason why I did really well was because people sort of they resonated and they appreciated the fact that I was actually an honest salesman.
Yeah.
Even though my boss would tell me oftentimes and he put me in situations where he wanted me to lie.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that, you know.
It's such a large investment though.
100%.
That like you can't lie to them because they're putting like everything that they've saved for into that.
It's the difference also just between like I bet you look at them as people with families and whatever, whereas I think the boss probably looks at them as just a sale.
Yeah.
You're not Mary and Joe, you're sale 378. And so it's easier, like they just disconnect. The minute you look at them as humans, then you have empathy and stuff. And so then you do care about them and so you care about making sure that
they're getting a good deal. And so I think it's just
integrity.
Yeah. Like you were saying.
I loved it. Honestly, like being able to help people, like that was my mantra.
Yeah. I feel like once you're not typecast, but like I've seen some of your previous podcasts, and I think what people need to show the public for their business or for their personality and what the real story is, there's often a disconnect.
Yeah.
And so I think you being able to show the real story, and sometimes it's the nitty gritty and sometimes it's the quaint and quirky, but it's just, it helps some people probably fill in the dots. And it is, it's, you know, it's one thing to be popular or get likes on Instagram, but if you know the backstory to that person, you can look at them in a completely different way.
100%. Like the podcast has never been clickbait.
Yeah.
Famous. Never in my wildest dreams. Like when I first started this, had an audience of 20. Now it's grown to about over 100. Yeah. You know, I'm honest with the numbers, with what's going on, all that sort of stuff, because what's the point in not being honest?
Mm.
Like you want to be
pretty bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't do that. Like people resonate with honesty. No one likes someone that lies to them directly in the face.
You like, watch fake shit. There's like MTV.
Yeah. There's the news every single night. Yeah, like you just sit there and watch it. Like there's so much power with media these days as well that creates so much negativity.
You're always getting a slanted story depending on
100%
which side's paying the bill.
Yeah. I don't like that. I don't agree with it.
Yeah.
I think it's just drama to draw people in, and the media gets paid millions for that. Whereas I want to share the real story. I want to reach as many people as I possibly can. If the podcast goes out, fantastic. You know, it's not going to change my mission or my vision.
Who's your like, not like dream list, but like someone you think your top three probably possible people to get on the podcast? So like, don't go saying Donald Trump, but like people that you think with a bit of effort, you could actually get on the show that you want on the show to either learn more or just get the opportunity to kind of probe them with some questions. Which three people?
That's a very good question, because I've thought about this so many times, and I'm a lover of film, always have been. I think like the number one person I put down on my list was Steven Spielberg.
I was going to say Mel Gibson.
I was
going to
say Hugh Jackman.
I know Hugh Jackman as well. Like he was on there, but he was like way down the list. And you know, like I do, my uncle's, he's in the industry, so he knows all these people and he could possibly link me up.
Certainly like would you have to go to him, or you think you could nab him when he's in Australia or something?
I could probably, like, you know, I've been reaching out through Instagram. It's been incredible. Yeah. Like the people that do reply. So I think if I was to like tell someone, or you know, like this is my goal.
Yeah.
Can you make it happen for me?
Yeah.
Then mate, who knows?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, of course.
Yeah. You don't.
You gotta try. Like you gotta put yourself out there.
That's what I did.
You might get ignored. You might get rejected. You might, like, certain agents might be rude to you. But on the off chance that someone intercepts the message directly, or they're in a good mood that day, that they open their inbox and they sort of give you the opportunity, run with it. You got to run with it.
My grandfather used to always say to me, he's like, Jared, you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah.
So if you want to ask, you put yourself out there. What's the worst they can do? Say no?
Yeah.
That's all right. You go find something else.
Yeah.
You know, like I was in a cinema. Like I didn't think that you were actually going to reply to my message. I was in the cinema about to watch Just Mercy, and I get a response, I think, within 5-6 minutes saying you're interested.
I live on my phone. So 6 minutes is a little slower than usual. I was
like, damn, that was quick. I was saying to my mum next to me, I'm like, I got Sir Isaac Eats. Like, this is amazing. Like, it's going to – cool. I didn't know what to really say.
Yeah,
like, and, you know, like, it's people like yourself that, you know, have an audience, have a story to share, that I'm able to do this kind of thing, you know, because if people didn't say yes to me, then I wouldn't be able to do it, really.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So going back to your question, the other two.
I got Spielberg.
I got Tony Robbins.
Yeah.
And there's one person that I think it was either John Howard, because he was like, no, it wasn't John Howard.
Can you do the whole podcast walking around Sydney Harbour in Wallabies tracksuits? You have to. You can't do a podcast with him if you don't do the whole podcast walking.
Okay.
I'll be there to live story it. Just let me
okay,
know.
Okay, we'll do that. All right. That's a goal. Okay. Who else was it? So it was Spielberg, Tony Robbins. Can't think
where, of it. Where do you draw the line? Like, do you have any issues talking about your strong integrity and ethics and stuff? Like, say you got Israel Folau. Very polarizing. But would you have any issue hitting those like religious questions where you know you're going to offend some people, you could alienate some people?
Absolutely not. I'd do it, and I'm one to get him on and talk about his story, because at the end of the day, it's a story. He's sharing it from his.
And he's obviously got a strong opinion. So if you're giving him a platform to share his opinion, then
100%. I mean, he's gonna share it. He shares it now at the moment. So all I'm doing is I want to hear his story. From his perspective,
give a slanted version through the media.
100%. Like everyone's got there's always two sides to a story. You know, oftentimes we only see what we're meant to see or what we're allowed to see. You know, we don't, but if we actually go to the person and we ask them ourselves, it might be completely different. Yeah. You know, so giving him an opportunity, like I'm trying to get Martin Lyles as well. He's the leader of the Christian lobby. Yeah. So he goes on. He supports Israel Folau and all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, being able to hear their story of where they came from, it would just be amazing, you know. Like he's a very intellectual person, very intelligent.
Hmm.
I think wouldn't even come up anywhere close
to. Have you come across it yet, but where you get deep into a conversation with someone and as much as you try and stay Switzerland and neutral – you do just find that like your opinions clash or your beliefs differ to theirs and you kind of have to bite your tongue because you feel yourself correcting them?
Like all the time. Like it happens.
Yeah.
Like you just have to realize that, you know, I'm more understanding now than I was before.
Mm.
Like everyone's got their own belief system. I appreciate the fact that you've got your own belief system just as much as you appreciate mine.
Yeah.
You know, it's that respect, I think. If you show that to people, then it's all right. Like you can still be friends with people even though you differ on ideas and all that sort of stuff, and you can still have a conversation. Like I loved debate in school. Like it was one of my favorite things. Not that I debate like with people on issues or anything. It's just we're having a general conversation. There's nothing wrong with that.
The intelligence, you know? I think, of conversation and probing and
Asking questions, because the more questions you ask people, then the more you're going to get out, I think, like you're doing now. So, no.
This is our podcast. We're asking him questions now.
Yeah, we switched it around now. Yeah. But, you know, I enjoy meeting new people. It's getting me out of my comfort zone as well. Like, whereas before, I wasn't able to do that.
Yeah.
Like, I would, like, freeze. I think being in real estate as well, the necessity of having to be there.
Yeah.
My first day, I was thrown in the deep end. I didn't actually have my license at all. And I went and did an open home. You're not allowed to give advice to people, your own opinion, unlicensed.
Yeah. So it's like doctors with their stuff.
So I was like literally so nervous.
No comment.
Didn't say anything. My boss's wife was just like, stick to the facts, you'll be right. But they don't want to hear the facts.
Nah. The minute they ask a question,
I was like, oh, no. What am I going to do? So it was like I didn't want to lie to them and I didn't want to get myself in trouble. So it was like a sticky situation trying to navigate. Good times. Good times. So I think finishing up, because I am mindful of your guys' time as well. So what are some things besides food that you're sort of passionate about and why?
I'd like to say travel, but I really just travel for the food.
<That's true>.
look, I never thought food is always going to be second to family. Like the minute I had a child, I always wanted children, but until I had my own child, I don't think I could describe to someone the feeling of just, I still can't put a word on it, but
being a dad,
just that sense of creation of absolute responsibility. Like I've had puppies, I've had this, I've had that. And you know what? Like you look at them and as much as you love them, they've got an infinite lifespan. They're relatively dependent. at the end of the day, they could fend for themselves. Whether it would have been regardless or whether because Teddy was premature, just the vulnerability and knowing that, like, that's now your vulnerability as well. Mm. So I think, yeah, travel and family probably.
Yeah.
Because sports is a hobby, but I'm kind of shit at sports, so.
All of the
so how do you keep, like, fit? Like, do you work out and?
Yeah, like, I grew up playing sport in Queensland, and so I've always enjoyed it. And then obviously working pastry and away in Melbourne, the seasons weren't as conducive to it. So I kind of got a gym membership, started just working out. And now it's just part of like a regular lifestyle thing. I'm obviously never going to be a bodybuilder. I'm never going to be the next like Chris Hemsworth or anything, but it's just a maintenance thing. It's a good time to clear your head. And I'm aware, like I always do a first thing in the morning. I know exercise is good for like endorphin release and things like that. So it chops and changes. Like I'll go through periods where I really get into weightlifting and then I'll go through periods where it's more cardio. But it's just a regular lifestyle balance.
Mm.
About in and out and an hour without kids once a day.
Getting your mind sort of focused and re-energized. Fine. Are you a 5 a.m. person?
Yeah.
Yeah, likewise. Get up, get out there.
If you don't do it, I think you're just always going to find the excuse. Whereas you get it done out of the way, like no matter what else happens for the rest of the day, it's done. Mm. If you get more done, great. If you sit literally still for the rest of the day, well, you got something done this morning.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. How about for yourself, Sam?
I used to play hockey. I had a break last year, but I play goalkeeper for a local club, Easts. So the kids play as well. So it's just a bit of a family thing that we do.
Yeah, good.
You've caught the travel bug now, but haven't you?
Yeah. So now that we've been to New York, we're going back again this year. Isaac's going to eat, I'm going to shop. So he was like, are you going to come for the afternoon? And I was like, no, I'm going to meet you back at the hotel later on and I'll do my own thing. But, I think last time we were there, what was it? How long? 5 days?
Yeah.
And he did, 51?
51 venue visits in 5 days.
In 5 days.
Yeah.
I'm lost for words. Like, you can see my face right now.
Planning was like I'd spreadsheeted it. I had maps with dots and logistics, which trams to get on, contact details for managers and stuff I needed to talk to. It was very...
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our poor arteries by the end of that.
Your poor arteries. You're like, I just want a bite of all the good bits. Thanks. Now I want more of the nice one I had.
It was literally a bite of all the good bits and spending the rest of my time at Jollibee in Times Square.
Okay, what's the best restaurant or cafe you've ever been to?
Oh,
shameless plug.
Australia?
I don't own any of them, so they can all pay me more money. look, I think they've all got strengths and weaknesses. Like we're really close friends with the owners of Burger Point Marsden Park. Mm-hmm. And they were like significantly, they were my first ever social media client.
Yeah.
They were with us through sort of Teddy's birth, Sam's treatment. Ironically, like they're probably my best performing client. They've also done, they're about to open shops 3 and 4 this year.
They've done so well.
There's potential, like they're getting interest from America for franchises. They're looking at the Philippines. Yeah. So although I'm not.
They're open to ideas though. I think
they're trusting.
Like being open to those ideas and taking those risks is what's going to like benefit you.
Yeah.
They're actually
plus the food's really good.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like, I remember when that first opened, and
the
everyone
one at Marsden Park.
Marsden Park, because I'm like right down the road.
It was like a barren nothing. Like, there was just IKEA. And I couldn't get over when we first met them, and it was really just nothing on Richmond Road, but the IKEA and the Costco. I don't think was even there. No, it was IKEA and the Homemaker Center, and you're like, oh, this is in the middle of nowhere. This is shit. And you drive out there now, 3 years on, and it's just housing. Housing and industry and such a boom area, and you're like, wow, were they just really lucky or very like intuitive?
My school is actually in Marsden Park, so
yeah, right.
If you, it's like when I first started going there, which is many, many years ago now, it was all bush, all covered, and then like they hit the jackpot because now it's like all developed. Yeah. And
so developing further, families. Like yeah. The closer you go out to Windsor, that road just gets more and more housing estates. And then across to like the whole Kellyville's developed. And eventually that'll just join up. I'm sure they'll connect it to a rail system somehow. And
the new metro line well. Like that's brought so many more families out, brought so many more cafes that are popping up everywhere. Like it's this massive trend now. I'm seeing so many cafes that are popping up all around the Hills District. Like, I mean, Castle Towers, if you walk into Castle Towers, there's heaps. Like you just walk around the corner, there's another cafe. Okay.
I feel like cafes are conducive to family areas because the people that own and operate them probably have young families, so they don't want to be out at night. The people, like bulk of their customers, like we don't go out to many dinners at all. Four kids, nighttime, they start getting a bit tired. But lunches, breakfasts, it's great.
Yeah. Mm.
So we'll go out as a family of six during the day, no dramas. But you start throwing, you know, night times into the mix and you sort it
becomes
of like
harder.
Yeah. And the risk of them, you know, during winter months, the risk of them getting cold in the dark and stuff. And so I think just cafes lend themselves to family areas and the new developments with all the housing estates are first homeowners, young families looking to buy.
Yeah.
It's the demographic. And then if you want dinner, you've still got to go to the major sort of metro areas, your Parramatta's, your Castle Hill, your...
Do you have a favourite donut place?
Yeah, mine's Donut Poppy.
I
can't go within like 5 kilometres of Redfern without getting her the Homer Simpson strawberry lemonade pink donut.
Homer. And I'm like, what, you came back empty-handed?
Yeah. I think the only time that I was allowed to not get that was when he went through the Biscoff phase. And then I was allowed to get you like the Lotus Biscoff donuts. But otherwise I have to get whatever I want and a pink donut.
Yeah. 100%.
Every time.
These donuts are, oh my goodness, they're sensational. So
if you, off the record, if you had to eat, if you had to pick between one of Roman's croissants or one of Kenny's donuts.
Oh, don't. Why?
And okay, should they collaborate and do their own Cronut together? Like,
I think they should collaborate. Yeah. I'm going to say, all right, because a Cronut is different to a donut.
Yeah.
So I love my Cronuts just because I'm a pastry man through and through. I'm also a donut lover. Like, okay, so... Oh, it's so hard.
Can you have half of each?
Yeah, just let's put it. I love
or just
love
eat them both, like just gluttony. Just
have them both. Like, you know, I love them both equally. Like in saying Sydney's best donuts, I'd say Donut Puppy.
Yeah, right.
And then Sydney's best croissants, I'd say Roman.
Yeah.
Like son of a baker, like for me.
saved it well there. Yes. Good job.
Real estate sold me well. No, I'm kidding. It's complete honesty. So finishing up, sorry. Have you 3 bits of advice you could give to someone that is starting out, going through a tough time at the moment or just needing a little bit of a boost?
Always like I think look at who you surround yourself with because it's often like you can have a great idea and be in a good place, but if the people around you are holding you back or keeping you down or just not being good for you in whatever space that you need that to be, then it's probably easier for you to change your environment and who's around you than yourself. So I think that and just the ability, like the importance of a support network. I think finding something that you enjoy doing or that you are inherently just good at and then trying to, you know, like 5 years ago, if you told me I could make money off running people's Instagram, I would have laughed at you. But I was good at it. I really enjoyed doing it. And so when I go to work 5 days a week now, as much as stresses come and go and employees are difficult to work with, like at the core of it, like I still love my job. I'm still like super blessed to kind of go like, oh man, I can't believe I'm getting paid to go and work at nice cafes and venues, eat nice food. And I'm like you, like I'd rather work with good people than, so there have been times where I've kind of knocked money back because I don't believe that I could work with the client or sell the food as premium when I know it's not. Type thing. So I think finding something you really enjoy doing and monetize it, surround yourself with good people that will help in that endeavor. And then just finding balance. I still struggle. It's probably the biggest struggle I have, finding the balance between switching off from work and family. But you need balance where you need time with family, you need time for yourself, you need time where it's sort of not unscheduled, but like sometimes you need to just be in the moment. Sometimes you need structure and organization. And so it's everyone's different, but once you figure out your own balance and whether that's, you know, your exercise regime or your diet or whatever, like you can kind of, it gives you control. Mm. And if you're struggling, like I feel like that feeling of not having control is what creates the most anxiety. Mm. So just start small, control what you can control, build up.
That's good. All good pieces of advice. Sammy, do you have any pieces of advice for people?
If you are lactose intolerant, make sure you take some lactase before digesting a lot of dairy.
Very wise.
Ironically, none of us are lactose intolerant.
Neither am I. Yeah. So, okay, so this is a fun bit. So your favorite film, your favorite actor, and the last film that you watched.
Last film we watched was, you watched Free Willy,
yeah,
Free Willy 2 on
no
Friday
judgment,
night.
No judgment.
Oh, Teddy. Oh, I watched the Tarzan with Skarsgård.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep.
On Saturday with Teddy.
One of the kids watched it and was you.
Yeah, it was me. Because I wasn't allowed to watch Blacklist while you went home because we're watching it together. The things I do for relationships.
Yeah.
I think, favorite actor.
Mine's Morgan Freeman. And I think if he ever does die, I'll probably cry.
Yeah. I think the whole world will probably cry with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my favorite movie is Mighty Ducks.
Ah, good.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Go on, show him the picture of...
Goldberg.
Yeah, Goldberg's an nice addict. The irony of it all. I think I'm a stickler for I mentioned it before off camera to you. Like Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Huge fan. Like Hook. My childhood is Hook. Yeah. And then you go through and like Flubber and Patch Adams. Like he does serious Good Morning Vietnam stuff. He does comedy.
Patch Adams.
Oh, Patch Adams gets me every time.
His voice control and like Bicentennial Man, I think, was one of the first movies I cried
Repeat.
In.
Yeah. What was that other movie he was in?
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. That was my childhood.
Yeah.
Like,
all those movies.
100%.
So good. Like so many good talents are going too quickly. You know, like.
It's like, are they going too quickly or are we just getting old and then we don't realize
how old? He lived a long life in terms of like Hollywood people and sort of sad stories.
Yeah.
But I think what concerns me is like, we only found out about the darker side in the final years. Like how long was he living that like with Heath Ledger, I think it was quite quick.
Mm.
But with Robin Williams, when you start looking deeper, like maybe it was 30 years of that comedic life where like you're a persona on stage, you're up, you're on, you're funny, off stage, you're upset, you're dark, you're and like then you just start going like that because that we hear about it when it happens to real like celebrities and stuff. But how many people in your office at work or at the restaurant in the corner having a coffee are like presenting as fine and like really cracked, really broken. So it's that I think like is the only positive to come out of those stories is like it shines a light on the concerns that we have in society.
Mm, 100%.
Was there best movie, best actor and something else?
The last one. Yeah, all good. And what's next for both of you?
Still doing the same thing that you're doing now. New York in October.
New York.
Let's get fat. We are ready to go. We're detoxing now and then we're going to get fat.
You're detoxing. I'm not detoxing. Yeah, I think I've kind of, like I said to you, I love what I'm doing right now. I've put changing like the status quo on hold until Teddy's in school. I really like the flexibility that the job gives me. And so as big a burden as it is some days with him on the road with me, being my only biological child and health circumstances sort of not allowing us to have any more, I want to appreciate and enjoy and be there for every second that I can of his growing up because once he's grown up, there's no going back.
Yeah.
Like I can start a business or open a restaurant or buy a food truck like anytime from now until I die. But his childhood and those moments, like, will only ever get once.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting really until he starts primary school. And then we've toyed with the idea of buying a restaurant or investing in something and sort of just using our knowledge and abilities and platform to start the next chapter.
Yeah. Like I'd love to see him get like a little show like on SBS that follows him around with food. I'm dying for us to try to get on Gogglebox.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
I say it every year and I'm waiting for someone else to drop off. But I was like, babe, let's just get on Gogglebox. Like just getting on there would be such a great opportunity.
I've got one more quick question and yeah. It might not be quick, but how do you guys, because you are rather famous on Instagram.
Yeah.
How do you guys manage that fame? Is there times where it becomes hard to manage or what's the sort of downside of it if there is one?
Oh, there is.
Nah, it all just goes straight to my head. I think no.
Hence why it's so big.
I think the biggest issue, not out of like people might think that you're getting stopped in the street every day. Like I'd be lucky if once a week someone picks me out of a crowd. And it's more so, I think, just because I'm like, I wear the same get up everywhere I go because it's like my entire wardrobe is black burger shirts, shorts. I nearly always have a cap on. And since I've grown the mustache, like it's kind of recognizable. So I don't think
signature.
It's. Yeah. Deliberate trademark. But no one's ever rude. Like I know myself, if I'm in public and I see an NRL player, like I obviously recognize who they are. 90% of the time in the back of my head, I'm like, don't be that asshole that asks for a photo. Don't interrupt them on their And I bet there's people out there like that to us. Some people are really polite and just introduce themselves, ask for a photo and move on. And that, you know, if you can make someone's day by doing something that small, then you'd be an asshole kind of not to, no matter what the circumstance you were currently in. I think the worst thing is like it makes you a target.
Yeah.
You don't have as much and celebrities go on about it all the time, but I said at the start, I'm water off a duck's back to me, like from the comp eating days, from childhood days, my skin is thick. So if someone calls me a name or slanders me or attacks me, couldn't give a shit. Once or twice, I've gotten myself into situations where it was me versus someone else, didn't think anything of it, like hell for leather. And then they've skewed and attacked my wife or attacked my family situation. And that is when I think it's the most obvious to me how vulnerable you are in the spotlight when you're on a pedestal. Because there is no privacy. There is no my account, like I'm fortunate. It's not the lifestyle type account where I'm sharing intimate things about my day. It's very food oriented. But people still kind of probe or know more about my life than they would the average person. Because I love my son, so I share him on my story when we're out eating food and Sam's on my story. And a lot of the story that we've told today has been conveyed publicly one way or another. But it's just and the laws around social media are very gray. So we were a victim at one point to a very serious attack of cyberbullying and trolling and stuff. We went to the police and they took a police report, really did nothing.
Wow.
Because they were kind of like, oh, what do you want us to do? Have you asked him to stop? Put a gun to his head, like seriously. And it was bad enough that Sam was taking days off work. She was getting secondhand friends trying to defend her who were then becoming victims.
Yeah.
It was a really malicious, really nasty situation. And Facebook, Instagram, as much as they've got headquarters and offices, they kind of like hands in the air like, oh, we're not responsible. It's like two private parties. It's your quarrel. The police didn't want anything to do with it. And then if you leave bullies to like sort out their own situations, it's never going to solve itself.
No.
And so I think that's the biggest downside of the fame.
You realize how gross people can be.
Just keyboard warriors.
In the sense that there's the troll, but then there's people that egg on the troll. And you look at those people and they've got public profiles as well. Like there are the big influencers. Yeah. But I can't believe that like they try to put out a persona of themselves that like they're such good people, but then they condone those type of attacks.
I think it's one of those instances where like, oh, the bully's funny until you're being bullied.
Yeah.
It's all fun and games until someone gets hurt.
But yeah. That was hard times. That was a hard time. I took a big break from my own Instagram after that because it just you don't expect to someone attack you, and he attacked like me and my
insecurities,
looks
like not just surface things, like if it's as if he smelt blood and sort of really went for a kill.
Yeah.
And you just wonder like what sort of person does that. Yeah. Like it's one thing, like I'm horrible for making, like I'm that token Aussie that makes racist jokes or very tall poppy, like if you're doing well, I'll slander you type thing. But you got to find the line between like, don't attack, and same, like I'll attack the person I'm talking to face, and I wouldn't say anything online that I wouldn't say to their face. If I think they're a effing idiot,
yep,
I'll call them an effing idiot. But I would never go like, oh, I don't like you, I'm going to find your mum, I'm going to find your daughter, I'm going to find, like.
Yeah.
That's taken a bit too far.
Yeah, that's and that's why I was so appalled that like even the police had sort of didn't want to hear about it or had nothing that they could do. And I think it's getting better. Like I know very recently before or after our incident, like cyberbullying laws got tightened. And I think the whole Facebook live streaming thing in New Zealand and censorship is like a very prevalent topic. If you could ever get someone from Facebook on podcast, just shout out Facebook.
We'll see. You never know.
So yeah, it's just catch 22.
Yeah.
You take the good times, but they're bad times.
I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you guys so much for coming on and sharing your stories. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure, brother.